Lane, Nebraska?
Always.
Nice. What about Kentucky?
I'm conducting the orchestra right now.
I see it. You got your hands going.
I'm ready.
You got like the theremin. Ooh. Welcome, everybody, to the Chromecast. I'm Luke.
I'm Josh.
And I am Jonathan.
And we three dudes are going to talk to you about grimoires one more time. This is season 7, and indeed it's lucky number 7 as far as episodes. And in this episode, we're going to talk about Robert E. Howard. He's an author that we're a fan of. We're going to talk about the grimoire Nameless Cults. We're going to talk about the Black Stone and perhaps the other story, Children of the Night, if time allows. And this is kind of our capstone to the season.
It's going to be 7 hours long to complete the 7 theme.
That's right.
Get your heart out, Dan Carlin.
I hope you guys are ready to settle in for a long one. Yeah. There are a lot more grimoires we could talk about and a lot more stories that sort of operate in this wheelhouse that we could have discussed, but 7 is a number of power. It's a prime number that we're a fan of.
And there's only days and episodes that can be done before Cromtober.
That's right.
It's true. Speaking of numbers, should we draw 3 tarot cards?
Oh, no, they're all the way over there.
We're not going to do that. That was a good idea.
No, we're going to keep it in there. That was me kind of screwing the pooch on that one.
Like, no.
I wanted to do the tarot card thing, and it just didn't. It didn't happen.
Would people say screw in the pooch? the tarot, I feel like that's something that we should pull back in at some point.
Yeah,
when we need it. I like it as an idea.
We'll come back to that.
Perhaps it will reappear in Cromtober.
Ooh.
Way to bring us back around, dude.
Your witchy ways.
But we can't talk about that. We've got a long road ahead of us this episode.
Time.
A long book.
What's the name of the book?
It's by Von Juntz.
Von Juntz.
And he's a German feller, so the book has a German title. It seems that not only is it a mystical tome, full of arcane knowledge and demons and such like that, but perhaps a divisive tome in that nobody knows how to say its name.
That's right, John.
True that.
And so we reached out to some friends of the show to ask for help on this endeavor. And so before we, I see you mixing your drink there.
I am, yeah.
While you do that, let's let our friends tell us how to pronounce this unnameable cult book.
Day it.
Let's start with our friend Rusty.
Hey gents, it's Rusty. I pronounced the name of von Juntz's nefarious tome Unausbrechlichen Kulten based on my really faulty 2 semesters of German in college and Shelley having German relatives who roll on the floor laughing at my pronunciation. So take that as it may. Unausbrechlichen Kulten.
Das ist gut, Rusty. Thank you. Ja. Danke.
That's not bad. And 2 semesters of German and a wife with German roots is more German than I have.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about like Raiders of the Lost Ark. That's the those are the connections that I can get there as far as, you know, pronunciations of things, right? Like the guy that comes into the Himalayan like tavern.
Uh-huh. And he's got he burns the thing on his hand, that guy? That's how you know some German.
I know more, but not very much more. Like that's the pronunciation guide that I'm going with here.
You go to Marika's.
Oh, that's true. I mean, there's that. I just never. I took Spanish for a couple of years when I was in high school, and that was my foreign language that I took part in, and so I really wish I could have taken like French or German to be able to, you know, get a little bit more. I don't know, just more. I like those words.
It turns out that we haven't had to pronounce any Spanish words really in this entire show, but lots of French and German words have been butchered. Let's turn to our friend Jeff. But first, let's remember Rusty had H sound in the middle of Unaussprechlichen Kulten.
Unaussprechlichen Kulten.
That's our friend Jeff Shanks. And he's got the hard CH, the K sound in.
Talk to Jeff.
Yeah. Thanks, Jeff. Let's turn to Mr. Chris Gruber.
Unaussprechlichen Kulten.
More akin to Rusty's pronunciation.
I think that was Conan, actually. Like,
that's what that sounded like.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Unaussprechlichen Kulten.
That's yeah. good stuff.
Future Google Translate voice.
Yeah. If I could have Chris's voice on my GPS, totally would.
Turn left.
Turn left. Let's hear from our new friend, Karen.
Hi, this is Karen Joan Kahotic, and I am here to pronounce the nameless. So let's give it a try. Unaussprechlichen Kulten. Thanks.
Sprechlichen Kulten. I can't do it all.
There was clear enunciation in that one.
Yeah, I like it.
Back
to the hard k sort of in the middle, right?
Yeah.
So we've got two k and two ch. So let's turn to our control group in this little experiment, our friend Dirk Gunther, who is from Germany and has two pronunciations for us. Let's hear the first one.
This is wrong on so many levels. Anyway, unaussprechlichen Kulten. Cringe.
Very German reaction.
Yeah, he cringed at the end. Let's hear the correct pronunciation of the German title for Nameless Cults.
Unaussprechliche Kulte.
Takes me back to German class.
So you took German?
Oh, yeah. I took 3 years of German in high school and I guess two at Purdue. I took a couple years of it.
Holy moly.
I found a cheat code at Purdue, though, where if I did more worksheets than I had to, she gave me extra credit. So I kind of coasted. Nice. My TA was impressed. If you filled out the whole workbook, you would get all the extra points. I don't even think I had to take the final.
Wow.
Yeah. So I don't actually know German, but I can say a bunch of stuff.
Say the German title for Nameless Cults.
Unaussprechlichen Kulten. I put a little too much Schwarzenegger in there. Maybe.
I think you have to. I think you have to. The opportunity's there. It's wide open for that.
Yeah.
So, I can ask you lots of questions, and you can try and guess what they are.
Let's hear one.
Was ist deine Lieblingsfarbe?
We're conferring.
I'm getting like Stein.
Yeah, you could have rot, oder blau, weiß, schwarz.
Talking about some beers or colors?
Nine.
Colors?
Kind of beer.
What color is your dad's shirt?
I asked what your favorite color was.
Blue, baby.
Blau. How do you say green in German?
Grün.
How do you say pink in German?
Ooh, das ist eine gute question.
We'll have to turn to Dirk.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Gunther. Yeah, so, he is the expert.
So in terms of the correct and the incorrect pronunciation, is there, like, what was the distinction that he offered there?
Let's hear him again. So here's the incorrect version.
This is wrong on so many levels. Unaussprechlichen Kulten. Cringe.
And that's the way that it's written, right?
Right. And the interesting thing is Howard never wrote the German title for it. In his stories.
Mm-hmm.
Someone else, I think August Derleth, gave it its German title. And I think this was done in written correspondence to H.P. Lovecraft. But Bobby Derry would know more. And so, Bobby, if you're listening, give us a call and let us know. Tell us the story of how the German title was bestowed to Nameless Cults.
And so the correct pronunciation that Dirk offers is not the way that it's written, right? But more of a proper sort of like representation of nameless cults as a title.
Right. So, so I think that the Unaussprechlichen Kulten should have a von Unaussprechlichen Kulten.
Okay.
If you were going to say those words in that order, okay. It's like you're saying, I don't know. I'm trying to think of an example. Like, if you, instead of saying, we went to the lake, you would say, we went to lake.
Right, right.
If that makes any sense. I think if I understand correctly, the spirit of what Derek's argument was in the Facebook message thread.
Instead of like, Book of the Dead, Book of Dead.
Book of Dead, yeah.
Gotcha.
I think. And so
there's lots of bastardizations of the pronunciation and the actual meaning of the book Nameless Cults, but yeah.
And I think German is a difficult language to speak. Maybe it's just because I don't know German. and I think that there are a lot of different ways, as you said, Luke, to pronounce these this word, like a lot of unaccepted sort of slang.
Yeah, right.
And I thought it would be fun, given our propensity for mispronunciation,
our long and storied history of trying to pronounce words
and failing. I thought it would be fun to get some other folks in on the game.
I dig it.
So thanks everyone for playing along, and we really appreciate it. That was a lot of fun. And Derek, thanks for the correct pronunciation of the German title for Nameless Cults that I'm not gonna try and say.
All right. So with that out of the way, let's talk about what we're drinking. Let's go ahead and move it along, John. What do you got there? Shock me.
Four Roses.
You did shock me. I was not expecting that.
Yep. Four Roses yellow label.
Nice.
Is it yellow or brown?
It's got a brown lid, I guess. The label here is still yellow.
Oh, yeah. Not here.
Is it got a wood top or a screw top?
Screw top.
Oh,
that's the old style.
Still yellow, dude.
Yeah. Yep. That, for those who have been listening, that's what Luke and I drank a few episodes back on the Book of Vibon episode.
I don't remember that.
I don't remember how it ended.
It's a surprise.
Clark Ashton who?
Clark Ashton, like.
What?
Yeah.
What do you got over there, Josh?
I've got a delicious beer from a local brewery here in Lexington that I think I've had on the show before, even here in the last couple episodes. This is Halfway Home American Pale Ale from Country Boy Brewing.
Little truck, toot, toot.
Toot, toot. A little field of, is that hops, I guess?
Yeah.
Tobacco? I don't know.
Little blue truck goes down the road.
It's good. It's, I think it's my favorite Country Boy beer. Sure.
Yep.
And then I see you with your gin.
My G's and my T's. I have the original Bombay Dry Gin. I don't necessarily splurge for the Sapphire because I like the straight English dry medicinal, like herby gin. And I'm kind of a tightwad. So for $15 a bottle, you really can't beat this. I mean, you can get Beef Eaters too, and that's the other gin that I'm a fan of. And I guess if I want to splurge, I'll get Tanqueray. But anyway, so we've got Bombay Gin, a little bit of some tonic water, specifically Canada Dry. It's probably a little sweet. I mean, if you're a snob, you'd probably have some fancy tonic water, but I'm not fancy. And then I've got like I've got a lemon here in front of me that I've already skinned like half alive. It's like the bastard of Bolton. Like
it's like you're gonna sacrifice it to the god of the black stone.
Yeah, I mean, it's been skinned out for making old fashions over the past week. But I'm squeezing a little bit of that juice in there, and I'm having some gin and tonic.
Delicious.
Yummy. That's what we're Chef's drinking. It's beautiful. That's what we're drinking. Let's do the one thing.
One thing.
You were quick on that poppity pop, like queuing it up.
I had it ready. Boom, boom. I was ready.
You got it there.
Unlike previous weeks.
John, what is your one thing?
My one thing is something that I literally just tried out a couple of days ago, so I'm not too deep into it, but I'm very intrigued by the first episode that I gave a shot to.
Yeah.
Excuse me. It's called Magic for Humans. It's on Netflix. It is a show where a comedian magician named Justin Willman does street magic and sleight of hand in front of people. And they make sort of a fun show about it where it's like these vignettes where he's interacting with people. The bit that really sold me on it in this first episode was they do a fake marshmallow experiment where they put a marshmallow on a plate and they tell a kid, if you don't eat this marshmallow, then I'm going to come back in 10 minutes and you can have two marshmallows.
Yeah.
And one kid fails. But then these other two kids, they're waiting. But he tells them before he leaves the room that if they put the cup over the marshmallow, it might help them to not eat it. And they both do it. And while he's out of the room, the marshmallow disappears from under the cup. And they freak out because it looks like they ate it. Now they're not going to get any marshmallows. But then he comes back and he makes like hundreds of marshmallows appear. And it was hilarious to watch these kids react to it. I laughed a lot. My wife was not into it. But I've always thought magic was cool. So if you are into sleight of hand or that kind of street magic edge, maybe check it out.
I want to check that out.
I see you queuing it up right now.
I am. I'm a big fan of the street magic.
Yeah. It's not like David Blaine or anything Chris like that. Angel. Like
it's not a mind freak.
No.
He didn't.
Chris Angel. It's not Chris Angel.
He didn't freak your mind?
No. It's just kind of funny. He has a magic bag bit where he pulls a full blender full of smoothie out of a regular backpack and freaks some people out. I think maybe I was in it for the reaction.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's on Netflix. So if you got a Netflix account, check it out. What's the picture that you use for your Netflix account? Are you a robot or a pirate or just a smiley face?
I'm the smiley face and I share it with my mom, who is the sort of disgruntled chicken.
Yeah, that's what my daughter is.
We're a smiley face.
Smiley face. Classic. It's a good choice.
It is a good choice.
I see a tiger and his name is Luke. So I choose him to do this one thing next. Yeah.
So my one thing is last night I was listening to some records. I was reading a book. And I was just sort of kicking back, and the record that I listened to that's sort of like I'd listened to a few times over in the past, but it really kind of just blew my mind with the listen last night was Emerson, Lake & Palmer's album Trilogy. So this is their third album. I'm not like a huge ELP fan. I'm more in the early era of Yes in terms of my prog rock preferences. An earlier Rush in terms of my prog rock preferences. ELP is a little bit jazzy for my blood, but man, that album Trilogy on the first side, it really has a couple different sort of like setups, but there's the song from the beginning, which is like a clear, like it's a pop song that you hear on the radio. And from there it segues into a song called The Sheriff and then Hoedown, which is like just this like just out the window, just crazy, crazy bonkers sort of tune. Like that album kills. It's just really killer. I love it. And last night I was really digging on it. And so I've listened to that album a couple times today.
Was that a recent acquisition or has it been sitting there a while?
No, it's one that I've had. It's just that I happened to listen to it last night. So I've got at least, I've got the first three ELP albums. And so Tarkus is the second one that's got the crazy armadillo, like
tank
with the gun and stuff. Yeah. It's bonkers. Like I like those records, but I like them in that I'll put them on and I'll be reading a book and I'm not like necessarily like plugged into it, which is different than how I like my Yes. Like I'll listen to the Yes album or the Fragile or Closer to the Edge, and I'll just like be plugged in and like actively listening to those albums while I'm just like sitting there, you know. My ELP stuff, like unless it's like Lucky Man, which is, you know, pretty poppy too, like you hear that on the radio, that's not a group of artists that I've really been on the jam for, but they're totally like virtuosic, like, musicians. And so I don't know, I'm going to have to listen to a little bit more, and maybe I'll have to get deeper into the latter ELP stuff. But, the third album trilogy is killer.
What could you do to make the prog even more powerful in your mind? Like wrap yourself in foil and like meditate.
I feel like I go to the future.
Like sensory, you know, deprivation chamber.
That's I was just thinking that, like, if there's some way that I could get like headphones that would be waterproof, so I could like be in the tub and have like a snorkel on where I'm just like in a vacuum.
Like Affleck in the Daredevil movie.
Yeah. That's that's how
I think this happens in an episode of the Venture Brothers. I don't know if you've ever watched that, but I think that they listen to what he's got some prog rock. I can't remember who he listens to, but he's in a sensory deprivation chamber.
It's got to be,
and all he hears is the music, and he goes on a magical, magical journey,
like 2112 or some of that Rush stuff.
Yeah,
I like my prog guitar centric, which is not what ELP is all about. Like, they get the crazy, like the organs and stuff coming out there, man. I don't know. I like prog rock. I'm not a prog nerd. I'm like a prog, like hang out and go to the concerts on the weekend kind of fan.
Hey guys, I'm just here for a weekend. Bye.
Just here for the tunes, man.
That's my like one thing. An album from like 1972. Josh, what's your one thing?
Mine is a pair of podcasts that I found. So I've been doing, I've continued my Hellboy reread. And I think about this time last year, I read the first three or four volumes on an iPad app that the library provides. And then for whatever reason, some update completely caused that app to stop working. And recently, and only recently has the app updated again, and now it works again. And so I've gone back. I've gone back to reread Seed of Destruction and Wake the Devil, which, like, at this point, I think I've read Hellboy more than any other comic book, maybe other than, like, you know, Watchmen and The Dark Knight Returns. And so it inspired me to look around for Hellboy podcasts. And I found two of them, and I only found them today, actually. And
oh man,
yeah. So I listened to the first couple of episodes on both of them. And
can I guess their names?
Yeah, guess them.
Okay, wait. All right, I want to think about this. Is one of them related to the Right Hand of Doom?
Nope, neither of them.
Dang. All right, I quit.
The Right Pot of Doom. nope. One of them is the Hellboy Book Club podcast, and the other is Aw Crap, a Hellboy podcast.
Nice.
Yep.
Nice.
They're both very good. It seems to me that Aw Crap is more of a sit down with the book and read it alongside them. So they go panel by panel, page by page, just sort
Holy
of
moly.
Yeah. So it's a deep dive. And then the Hellboy Book Club, one of the hosts, and I apologize, I only found them today and I don't remember everyone's names, but one of the hosts is really into folklore, and they are, anytime some folkloric or mythic, aspect comes up, which is like every other page,
right?
This co-host on, the Hellboy Book Club podcast just sort of dives into the myth behind it, cool. Just kind of a brief bite-sized synopsis of it. And so, you know, you get some information about Baba Yaga and Hecate and various characters within the Hellboy universe. It's pretty cool. So it's like watching the Hellboy DVD with the commentary on.
Man.
Yeah. So I'm doing a real deep dive into Hellboy. And all this came about because of David Harbour's Hellboy movie that's coming up. So David Harbour is the sheriff on Stranger Things. And he is going to be Hellboy in a film that's coming up later this year, maybe sometime next year.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay, cool.
And so I saw some promotional footage from that and was all in.
Man, you dirty dogs. You've got some good one things. I'm going to have to pick out all of these things.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
We'll include the links. I followed them both on Twitter from the Crimecast account, and we'll keep up with them. They're both pretty new, which is pretty neat. Cool. They just started in 2018. So
are they going like chronologically in terms of publications?
They seem to be following the library editions, like the omnibus edition.
Oh, snap. I have those.
Yeah. So, if you read the trade paperbacks, I think some things that happen in The Chained Coffin and others, occur before the events of Wake the Devil.
Right.
But Wake the Devil is volume two. And so I think there's some weird chronology there. And they talk about that, but they're going definitely in a more publication centric.
So it's definitely not like any of the miscellaneous weirdo one shots that are like this little snapshot of Hellboy's life. Like those would get plugged
in. Like where he's a luchador?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Like
I haven't made it that far. And honestly, I don't think they have made it that far either yet.
Okay.
But I do know like the last one I listened to this afternoon, from Hellboy Book Club was about The Chained Coffin and what are some others? The Box of Evil, Box Full of Evil. So it'll be interesting to see how they deal with some of the weirder like Hellboy in Mexico and the Krampus one that came out last year. And
you got me all like jonesing to go read Hellboy right now.
And Hellboy is it's just so good. I like to read it just... I could start over again and read Seed of Destruction again and pick out something new that I like about the art.
Thanks, Mike Mignola.
He's the bomb. Yeah. I pulled out Fell the other day.
Oh, nice.
Like, just because. And I don't know. I'm going to read some comics.
Warren. Uncle Warren.
Finish something.
We'll probably have Mike on the show someday.
That would be awesome.
I would love to talk to him.
I mean, we're big time now, right? We're the realness.
We are no longer a new podcast.
It's true.
We're half a decade old.
Yes. That doesn't seem like it should be true, but it is.
I think the way to pitch him on it is that we are essentially haunted by Baba Yaga every October.
You think Baba Yaga is the witch?
I mean, at minimum, like second cousin, right?
I have our intro for the Cromtober. I have it.
You just came up with it?
Yep, I have it.
But we aren't going to tell you.
Nope. Instead, we're going to wrap up this segment of the show where we give you three things that we're interested in, wrap it all up in one shiny package, and call it
One Thing.
Right on. All right. So, guys, we're gonna segue into content here. We're going to talk about Howard. He's our bro.
Yep.
He is our bro. We've been to his house.
We have been to his house. Unfortunately, the dude wasn't there. I couldn't talk to him.
Nope.
He was there in spirit.
He was there in spirit. I mean, we're being a little bit facetious, but that was a very powerful moment.
It was crazy.
Yeah.
I got ate by chiggers that live on his property.
No kidding.
You still have scars on your leg. I think.
I'm looking at them right now.
Howard Days is not for the weak. Like someone of lesser constitution would have given up and died.
But I've read Una Throcklachen Colton.
The Unspeakable Cults.
The Unspeakable Cults.
Have you been to Western Europe and searched out a monolith that stands on a hill? Is it Western Europe? Or where are we?
I have been to Western Europe. And I have been in the hills. And I felt like I was being haunted.
You're more traveled than I, sir.
Did you go to Hungary?
Nine.
Did you go to Germany? Yeah.
No, I went to France and Italy.
Okay.
Which are neither Germany nor Hungary.
Nope.
Were you like mountains Italy or like?
We were in the mountains of France. We were on like the Pyrenees border with Spain, and we were in this big cabin that was quite cavernous. And there was a boy room and a girl room, and they split us up. And
is it
was weird.
Because you were like little tykes or because
that we were college students.
Yeah.
And they were like, no chocolate peanut butter.
I don't get that reference. But
yeah, I don't either.
Sex. I'm referring to sex.
Chocolate peanut butter.
I mean, maybe that's,
edit that out.
That's like a... No, we're going to keep that in, dude.
Yeah,
no,
yeah, we're keeping that in. I don't know where to go from here, so I'm just going to say that The Black Stone was published in November of 1931 in Weird Tales.
It's widely lauded as a an REH classic. It's his sort of attempt at like the most Lovecraftian story, I think, that he has written. Is that fair to say?
I think that's fair to say. Yeah. I think this is Howard playing in the Lovecraft sandbox, the mythos. And if you contrast this story with Pigeons from Hell, then you get a more southwestern folkloric sort of, you know, Texan sort of horror story.
Yeah, this is I don't want to say it's Lovecraft or it's Howard like putting on airs, but it is him writing in a sort of European fashion.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really key point to make, is that Howard writes like an American in most all of the situations that we've discussed him, but this feels very European. Like even Howard's most European character, Solomon Kane, like he would be just right at home at Texas, yeah. In Texas.
And so that gets at the point that Lovecraft, you know, wrote in that sort of fashion and wrote in a weird way that's not, you know, common across a lot of the pulp writing, you know, mm-hmm. or at least it wasn't before people started to sort of like latch on. Yeah, right. And so this is in that style.
They say foul things of old times still lurk in dark forgotten corners of the world, and gates still gape to loose on certain nights, shapes pent in hell. By Justin.
Justin, yeah. Justin G. I wrote down, a nameless narrator finds mentions of a black stone in the writings of von Juntz and Justin Joffrey. He travels to Hungary, to the village of Strigoikovar, on summer vacation, summer break, in search of this artifact, but instead learns that some secrets should never be unearthed, and cults dedicated to the worship of strange deities once lurked in the dark places of the world. But do they still?
So yeah, our dude, he reads about the nameless cults, and he gets a real hankering to find out more about it. It's sort of a classic weird tale setup where there's unspeakable logic that nobody really should know, but it's of an age of bygone eras, and he desperately wants to know it. So he's going to figure out what the Black Stone is, travels to Hungary to do it, hangs out in that village, and it just so happens he's there on Midsummer's Night, which is important, right, Josh?
Yeah, he finds this out by discussing the Black Stone with a local tavern keeper who said that on Midsummer, if you go there, you'll see visions that will haunt you forever and you'll have nightmares until you die.
Yeah, you definitely shouldn't sleep around the Black Stone. You shouldn't camp near it because you will have terrible nightmares forever, which is what happened to the innkeeper's nephew, if I remember correctly.
I think so. You should never.
Yeah, he got lost in the woods.
You should never make direct eye contact with it.
No, you shouldn't talk about it. You shouldn't think about it. You shouldn't look at it. And it's something that's really sort of the focal point, is it, of the unspeakable cults?
It's a focal point. It's a focal. The unspeakable, the unnameable cults book. It seems to be a collection of just cults and their various esoteric practices. And
there's lots of mention of keys.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So some of these artifacts that are mentioned within the von Juntz book are referred to as keys, but and capital K keys, but there's no real elaboration beyond that.
So they're kind of like maybe important like fixtures on the landscape, right? Like that's kind of the gist that I'm getting here, like the yeah. Various like this monolith is a key.
Mm-hmm. but
or to call back to a previous episode, maybe they're gates 1 through 8.
right
or maybe it's the warp zone that takes you right to Bowser's castle.
We kind of get a Bowser-like figure in this story.
So Thagwa is the Bowser?
I guess. I mean, they're both reptilianoids, right?
Yep.
Well, amphibian, reptilian.
I think it's logical.
I think it's cool that you jumped to Sathagwa. Why did you do that?
I mean, I've seen that reference. I'm not going to lie. Like, that's something that I've seen pop up. But also, like, the cover of that wolf's head, like, Lancer paperback has, like, the sort of herpy, like, god on top. Like, herpy being, like, herptile.
Not herpes.
herpy. Like, a herpetological organism on top of a black monolith. Like, it's basically like the sort of like froggy reptilian god, which within the Cthulhuid mythos / Clark Ashton Smith like playpen is that.
Yeah, I ran across some speculation, an article online titled "Who Was Worshipped at the Black Stone," where the author speculates that it possibly is Sathagwa.
Okay.
But it could also, he draws in the name of the town, the area, Zuquatl.
Oh, okay.
Help me out. Zuthal? That's what the reference is to, right? Zuthal of the Dusk.
I think it's the Hypnotoad. It's the
Hypnotoad. All glory to the Hypnotoad.
But if we were going to... Oh, wait, you're looking for something.
Yeah, I've got a point that I want to get out there before we move away from
this. Just tell me to F off.
F off, dude.
Thank you.
I know the damn word you're talking about.
Zuthultan. Zuthultan. How did you pronounce that as you read it?
Okay, so I made the connection of like Zuthul of the Dusk, which is the other thing that I've seen references to, right? So
exactly.
Zuthul.
Yeah, so this is Zuthultan. Which draws to mind Zuthal of the Dusk, but that story was written, or released anyway, in 1933.
Okay.
This one came out in 1931, so it predates it. And here we have a very froggy kind of entity, might be referenced to Sathagwa. Interestingly, the monster in Zuthal of the Dusk is Thog, which is one of the syllables of Sathagwa. So maybe... Thog is from Zuthal of the Dusk.
Sex frog. Thog
is the sex frog in the Black Stone.
Right.
Is Sathagwa from the Clark Ashton Smith universe?
Sex frog, new band name.
The Smithos. I don't know. These are kind of disjointed thoughts. So anyway, I think it's cool. The way that the Black Stone kind of forms this linchpin that potentially connects the three major players in Weird Tales that we have considered on the show.
Yeah.
So do we want to focus more on the Black Stone or the book?
I think let's quickly talk about the story arc of the Black Stone. Because I'm not going to say it's not memorable, but it is of a type,
mm-hmm.
right? So let's talk through that, and then maybe we can get into the book and sort of like what the larger meaning is.
Sure.
So in this story, we have a scholar,
which is cool because like that's a total Lovecraft thing, right? Like mm-hmm. how many other, with the exception of Kirwan, how many other Howard protagonists are scholars?
Like explicitly, just as a job. Yeah, because like Conan's not a scholar; he's a king that happens to be a well-read dude at various points in his life.
And Cole seems to dabble in philosophy, but certainly isn't a scholar.
Right,
Conan the librarian.
it just seems not completely unique, but rare.
So in this case, there's a storyline relating to a book. So within the very front matter of the story, we get the introduction of the grimoire, and that sort of motivates the story for how things play out. And so, as we've said, our academic goes...
He's going to Stregia Kvar.
Yeah, he goes seeking out the location of the Black Stone. He finds it. It just so happens, happen chance, Midsummer Night, there's a dream... horror that like a nightmare that sets in that really sort of like relates to some ancestral sort of like memories here, and horrible things are observed, and then the story it's sort of the unveiling of the horror.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's lots of other sort of books that are invoked during his travels to the hills to find the Black Stone. He talks about a book from Dostman called Remnants of Lost Empires from Der Drachenhaus Press. And he's got a poem, The People of the Monolith. And they all sort of circle around the Black Stone and the history surrounding this area, which involves a count, a Hungarian knight named Boris Vladenov, who made a stand against Suleiman when the Turks swept through Eastern Europe in 1526, but was killed in a cave-in in sort of a temple. Is that what fell on him?
Yeah, I think they were inside the castle battlements, and he was sort of busy deploying his men when he was handed something in a lacquered box. And when he realized what it was, then the castle wall fell on him.
So this is sort of a haunted area, it seems. Like, there were people here before the people of Strigo...
You said it so well a second ago.
Strigoi Caviar.
Strigoinkova.
Strigoinkova.
Yeah, welcome to Strigoinkova.
The people from the bottom of the hill came up and swept out the people that were at the top of the hill, who were sort of an unchristian pagan folk. And then Suleiman came. And so this is an area that's been conquered, unconquered, reconquered over and over again. And it has a long history. And the Black Stone turns out to be a very key part of it. So our narrator goes on Midsummer's night and takes a nap next to it, has this weird dream. And if you were to just sort of bare bones describe what he sees, what would you put it as?
I mean, he ends up seeing a ceremony of sorts wherein we have like a sort of a virginal mother figure. We have an actual, I mean, is that true? I mean,
mm-hmm. I was thinking virginal mother figure. Yeah, you're right.
like it's
we have a nude lady and then a baby, certainly. Yeah. Sorry.
I was mixing. I mean, that's a good point. Like, those two are a little bit juxtaposed, but ultimately we get like a baby sacrifice, which is like really the most horrific element within the story, as far as like, that's the thing that when I first read this story a couple of years back really, really struck me. It was just, it's grotesque. Like, the level of primitive, I don't know, like spiritual, whatever weird like religion is motivating this, it's just bonkers.
Savage. It's savage.
Yeah, there we go.
In the antiseptic way in which he kind of describes it.
Yep.
And, you know, that scene to me is the thing that sets us apart from a Lovecraft story, because that sort of level of gore is largely missing from Lovecraft's stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's like Howard got to that point and is like, okay, I got to make this mine, I got to add some blood and thunder, and boy did he.
Yeah, and I mean, there's savage like lashings and beatings that are untold upon the woman there.
And I think we could dig into this scene. We don't have to be totally explicit, but like the person who's doling out the whipping to the girl is dressed like he's some sort of shaman, right? Mm-hmm. Like he's largely nude except for a wolf head mask.
Right.
And he is using this bundle of reeds and just whipping her as she's doing this crazy dance, and he's matching her step for step and whipping her all the while this withered crone beats a drum and the people in the crowd are chanting and the smoke from the brazier is sort of coiling up around the Black Stone. And then we had this horrific murder of the infant.
Yeah.
And suddenly the crowd goes silent, and we see at the top of the spire toad-like figure.
A huge, monstrous, toad-like thing squatted on the top of the monolith. I saw its bloated, repulsive, and unstable outline against the moonlight, and set in what would have been the face of a natural creature, its huge blinking eyes, which reflected all the lust, abysmal greed, obscene cruelty, and monstrous evil that has stalked the sons of men since their ancestors moved blind and hairless in the treetops.
So there's this sort of unholy revelation, and sort of what plays out after that as the academic sort of like wakes up.
He wakes up and he thinks, well, was it just a dream? And he goes to the site that John mentioned earlier, where the leader Was it the leader of the Turks?
Count Boris.
Count Boris fell. He knows that he was supposedly given a lacquered box, and he wonders what's in there, and he finds it, and it turns out it's a pendant that depicts this frog deity, right? And he learns, he also learns that some of the soldiers cornered this horrific toad monster in a cavern and ended up killing it with their I think this was the Turkish army killed it with their blades that were blessed by Muhammad, right? Like right. This is another Howardian aspect of the story, like men taking action against these elder god like beings.
Yeah, these guys outright killed a god. It's interesting to me that they're Turks, that they're not necessarily like they're the kind of the antagonist as far as like the locals are concerned with what the story is here, but they've ultimately like drove back the evil so that it's just this weird sort of dreamy like Midsummer Night thing that happens.
And so I think upon first reading the story, I thought that the narrator had a dream, but the more I think about it and the significance of this happening on Walpurgis Night or Midsummer's Night, and the fact that the priest in the vision was wearing a chain but was missing a pendant, like something was obviously missing from it, there was a broken link, and later he finds that the rest of the pendant, right? I think what's actually depicted here in my interpretation of the story is not necessarily a dream, but a ghostly repetition of events that have occurred there on this at the site before. Think of in Fantasia, like the Disney Fantasia, Night on Bald Mountain, and this one night these ghosts can do their thing, and this demon emerges from the mountain.
Zernobog.
Like, yeah, like I think this is what's wait. I think that's what's happening here. I think that's what's happening. I don't think it's a dream. I think it's a vision of the ghosts of that haunt this place. And I think the aspect of the black stone as a key, the black stone as a key that unlocks this ghostly vision, right? And potentially could allow these things to return in full force.
Yeah, some reactivation of it, yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting idea. Like we could get a Wicker Man kind of thing where the Strigoi Kvar people start to reenact all of this again and because they need some help.
I think it's
Is it just the night that the toad has the power to... Like, you can't kill this monster, right? I mean, you can maybe decompose its physical form. But maybe on this magical night, it can replay one of its most cherished memories.
Good point. Yeah. So in Zuthal of the Dusk or the Slithering Shadow, Conan doesn't kill Thog, right? He wounds it to such an extent that it dives into this pool. And he says, even at the end, like, oh, I didn't kill it. Like, you know, that's a good point, John. Maybe this is, you know, just that horrible toad god sort of dead but dreaming in a very Cthulhu kind of way.
Yeah, maybe.
The story also makes mention of the black stone as at one point sort of being a spire on the top of a fortress.
A cyclopean fortress.
Yep, it's got to be cyclopean. So what do you make of that?
I think I thought that was a part that was very interesting, like a nice wrinkle to me, was this idea that this is all that we can see and it's all that we can interact with now, but just like it's almost this simile or something for the magical past, the horrific magical past of the earth, where we have just this barest glimpse of what it is and we can claw at these books like von Jüns's. And we can try to read through that stuff and get a taste of it, but we'll never fully know. If we really dug down and looked in our history, maybe we could interact with it. Like if maybe they excavated these mountains, they could find the whole castle or discover that it's a castle. But for now, all we get is this little glimpse, this shimmer that's still very powerful, but it's only a shade of what it could be.
What do you think, Luke? Are we way off base here?
No. The reason that I like this story so much is that it's truly horrific. I like the fact. I don't want to. It's not exploitative, but the same way that like Bloch's Shambler in the Stars is not Lovecraftian because you see all of the gouts of blood and all of the horror. Within this story, you see all kinds of crazy horror sort of playing out. And so your imagination is not left wondering in a lot of those instances, but there's a lot of question marks about what does it like mean in air quotes here. And so at the back end of the story, is it ghostly? Is it sort of a revelation of like, this is the stuff to come? That's what I like about the story, that you can see sort of like time. What am I trying to say? The veil between the worlds is very thin. Mm-hmm. There's sort of like some mystical nature that's being suggested here, and you don't know what's real ultimately and what may ultimately like turn out to be real. I said ultimately there twice, but it gets to the point that like we don't know the timeline here that we're sort of like playing with. It seems as if it's like from the past.
Mm-hmm. But it could be from the future.
Yeah, or it's like these are the things that could continue. Like it's that kind of deal.
Or could be continuing if the toad monster hadn't been dealt with on that fateful day.
Right. And I mean, that's thinking about like what the sort of like Louisiana component of Call of Cthulhu, where uh-huh. you get like you know, in some deep, dark little recess of the world, there is a Cthulhu cult in an area where that shouldn't even be going on. It's like there's this active sort of worship of this old one. Here, it's the same thing. Like there's some sort of persistent memory or some sort of grounded base for that.
So, what is the source of the horror in this story? Like, what makes this story scary to you guys?
To me, it's... I'm sorry, I'm jumping. Jump in.
No, please.
To me, it's the point that it's... like, the evil was not eliminated. Like, to me, that's the thing that's cool about it, is that it's... we have the darkness being beat back, but it's clear, with what our academic sees, that it's still there. There's some threat. And so it's that sort of omnipresent threat. Like, you can't cut out every single cancerous cell. There's something there that's gonna like blossom.
And that's just the one we know about.
Right.
Mm-hmm. How about you, John?
For me, it's that it goes back to that sort of Hellboy sort of angle of, we don't really know what happened in the past. Like, we plumb the depths of our history as a species, and we have our theories and our pet projects and our ideas, but the idea that is put forth in this book or in this story and in other weird fiction tales of, but we don't really know what came before us. Like, we don't know what else the primordial soup put forth and what horrors lie underneath the world, underneath the earth, that there could have been something truly terrible that came before us. Not just dinosaurs, but like something ungodly and cyclopean and mystical and nasty and hellacious, and that it waned in power and we rose in that wane, but how long does that really last?
Right.
Like, if you're talking Book of Revelations kind of stuff, you know, we hear the phrase, what is time to the Lord? What is time to God? A second is a year, is an eternity. And so to these creatures, maybe this is the blink of an eye in their power. And there's these keys all over the world that could unlock them and let them out. And all it's looking for is a curious scholar to let it loose. And there's so many of us that fall into that camp, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's our natural inclination as people. And it's what has served us well as a species. But could it be the key to our downfall, where we get so curious that we unleash the very things that that could have prevented us from taking control of our planet?
Did you guys see any parallels in the story to other non-Lovecraftian horror tales? That are maybe partly set in Western Europe?
Like Dracula?
Yes. I'll stop being obtuse. Do you think that this story is in any way connected to or inspired by Dracula?
I mean, I think you get some of the deeper sort of like history that plays out in Stoker's Dracula, like here, like just the relationship between East and West, right? Like the Europeans versus the Ottomans and that sort of clash. I think that's a core source of contention or sort of argument. Like that's two different civilizations coming against one another. And I think that's reflected in this story very, very specifically. Like I mentioned before, but the fact that the Turks slayed, you know, the frog sex god, or beat it back, I think is interesting. You know, that's sort of, I don't know, I haven't thought about it in the context of Dracula, but in that case, we have Count Dracula being a representation of the sort of European civilization, though.
It's true, but he represents the old ways, right? Like, he's from the west of Europe. He's from a rural area. He's from the countryside, versus, like, he's coming to London, right? Like, he's coming to this urban center. This is civilization. Mm-hmm. And this barbarian is coming into a civilized place. And how do these things clash with one another? And to me, this story has that in a very explicit way, as Howard, as only Howard could put it, where in the Turks represent civilization, and these mountain folk that worship Sathagwa represent barbarism, and they are clashing with one another. And our narrator, like, the horror here is very civilization versus barbarism inspired, because the narrator realizes that these ancient barbaric practices could reemerge and plunge the world into chaos yet again.
But that's an interesting thought there, is that Howard, a Howardian story, is always, like, in most of those, it would be these hill folk that worship Sathagwa. They would be the ones that topple the walls of Suleiman's greatest city and plunge those people back into barbarism. But in this case, we have a smoothing over of barbarism by first Suleiman and then these Hungarian people of Caviar Town.
Witch Town. It's Witch Town. That's what it translates to, roughly, I think.
Right.
Well, think about people of the Black Circle and Conan saying, yeah, you know, I was one of the Sumerians that raided that Aquilonian fortress, right, when I was young.
Uh-huh.
And I, in that way, can sort of see a kinship with these Picts that are moving in on Aquilonia's borders here. But the Picts are the villains in the story, right? Like, in the people, did I say people of the Black Circle? I meant beyond the Black River. Mm-hmm. The Picts are the villains of that story, but they represent barbarism, which Howard typically champions, right? And even in the story, he says something to the effect of, civilization will always be beaten by barbarism. Barbarism will always triumph. But he's not saying that as necessarily a good thing.
Yeah.
And I think here he's saying it again in a slightly different way. And yet again, that's not necessarily a good thing.
It's just a pragmatic sort of statement that the wild will sort of overcome.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I like that, man. That's a good way to think about it.
And so, thank you. I didn't know. Like, I still feel like there's a strand that is dangling that needs to be tied up somehow. And I don't know how to incorporate that strand.
I don't know that statement, though, that sentiment, I don't know, for whatever reason, really does like resound, like that, that seems, that strikes true to me, that that's sort of like some statement of, for better or worse, the way that things are damned to play out over time. That's a pretty sort of cynical worldview. And I think it's like Howard himself knows or knew the sort of the good and the bad that would come out of that sort of barbaric perspective. Like, it's all a gradient, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so total sort of wild is going to overcome everything. Like, everything's going to go back to seed and back to just the primordial sort of ooze. I don't know. That rings true as like a truly sort of cynical sort of worldview and a pretty horrific sort of statement.
So given that this is the season on grimoires, and the grimoire in question on this episode is the Unspeakable Cults, what did you guys think of Howard's application of the book and also the author in this story? Like, how does this fit into the season?
I think this is a great example of like how a grimoire can kind of motivate the story, the same way that like the Ninth Gate, the movie was sort of motivated by like the search for a magic book. That tome sort of motivates the jumping across the world and going to this far out, like, exotic locale.
I guess that I think of this as one of the better grimoires that we've looked at, in that it contains forbidden knowledge and it takes only the clever of mind and the stout of heart to find it. Like, a grimoire is supposed to contain that sort of arcane, mystical information. And while he doesn't conjure a demon or anything, it sets him on the track that he needs to be. So I thought it was a really good grimoire. And I hope that none of us ever find it at Half Price Books and open it and do the same things that he did. But I think that it was a good one. And I like these tantalizing bits, right, that we get of, well, it was published here and it was written there and it's been translated and bastardized over and over again. But that flavor, that historical flavor that would come from a bibliophile like Howard, I liked that touch that he put on it.
I did too. And I like, you know, you said, I hope we never run across this book at Half Price. Like, think about the Frenchman in this. I think his name is Ledoux, that finds Von Juntz's notes. Like, Von Juntz was writing a second volume. Uh-huh. And as he was writing it, a demon tore his throat out, right? Like, very reminiscent. He
cut his own throat out with a razor.
Yeah. So he read the materials and then slit his own throat.
That's how I feel when I read scientific papers.
Don't do it. That's a trap. yeah, I think that both to have a successful mythos grimoire, you have to have an author who is steeped in mystery, who meets a horrific end by a supernatural entity. And then the book itself has to go through substantial translations into various languages and have mysterious circumstances surround it.
But within this story, it's more than just like broad, like super broad strokes. It's not just like a couple different references to a book. Like, here we have clear sort of statements about like the, what's the right word? Like the pedigree.
The lineage.
Lineage, yeah. The pedigree of the story, like for what this book is and what Von Juntz, like who he was.
Mm-hmm.
Which really digs even more into this Howardian feel, right? This idea that not only did it exist, but it's been corrupted over time by successive generations who are more and more civilized, who understand the principles of the original matter less and less. They're so far removed that if we wanted to delve into it, their genetic memory is fading. They don't know what it is they're referring to. And so they can't translate it properly. They can't understand it properly. They can't say Unis Brachlachen Kulten properly. Right. It's this weird corruption that Howard sees with the civilization happening to humanity.
Yeah.
Go us. We killed it.
Well, I think this is all good content. And so I dug into some of Howard's letters. And I have to thank our buddy Rusty Burke for sending us some of these materials, just to see what Howard thought of his writing here. And so this is from a letter. This quote is from a letter from REH to August Derleth from 1933. He says, "You're right about the Black Stone and other kindred yarns of mine. They were written more as experiments than anything else, and I soon saw that they were not my natural style." So here he's saying, like, you know, this was just kind of an experiment. Uh-huh. I was playing in the sandbox. It didn't fit, so I moved on. I would argue that it did fit, but it seemed a little too similar maybe to other people's styles, and his own style was yet to really develop. He wrote to Lovecraft in October 1931 and said, "Since reading The Black Stone over in print, I feel rather absurd. The story sounds as if I were trying in my feeble and blunderingly crude way to deliberately copy your style." So he's kind of self-effacing here, saying, yeah, you know, it's just a copy of your stuff. Like, it's not really all that good. I'm not sure I like it. He said, you know, a similar thing to Derleth. But listen to this letter, this excerpt of a letter to Tevis Clyde Smith. This is from 1930. "The Weird Tales story, a short one that brought $64, was infinitely better." He's talking about the Gods of Baal Sagoth here. "Was infinitely better, though marred by a clumsy style and a too melodramatic development." So he's saying that he's referring to Black Stone, and he's saying it's better than the Gods of Baal Sagoth.
Uh-huh.
"Too melodramatic development. It carried out the theme I mentioned to you in a previous letter. The title is The Black Stone." So he's saying it's better than his other horror stories. It's not a bad story.
Yeah.
He's thinking some pretty positive thoughts about it. He says, "It is the best attempt at bizarre literature that I have yet sold." So, you know, it seems like to his peers slash rivals slash inspirations, Derleth and Lovecraft, he's saying, this isn't very good. You guys do it better. But when it comes to his buddy, who he, you know, has known for most of his life, he's pretty proud of this story.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a intentionally direct sort of antecedent to Lovecraft. He's not doing his own thing. He is writing in that style, and for that reason he's a bit torn in how it comes across, right?
I think so.
Yeah. It's not bad. It's not a pastiche. Like, off mic before we started this episode, Josh, we were talking about like what makes a pastiche versus an homage. This seems to have like bits of Howard, this is corely like a lot of Howard materials. There's clearly Lovecraftian writing style and Lovecraftian terms and sort of like tropes that are at play here, but there's a lot of Howardian themes in the mix, like things that we would see in other stories. So he's not just aping another author that he looks up to.
Yeah, I think so too. Like, this is Lovecraft through a Howardian filter.
Yeah.
It's not a pastiche. It's not a poor copy. It's an interpretation of a style. It's like, you know, if someone took the sheet music of a Beethoven piano concerto and played it, but they put their own spin on it, right?
Yeah.
Like, you're playing the notes, but you're making it your own thing.
Right. That's readily apparent with a lot of the fever pitch horror elements that come across.
Yeah. So, man, The Black Stone, good yep. story. And obviously fits well into the discussion of fictional grimoires.
So where do you guys want to go from here? Do we want to...
So at the top of the show, top of the episode, we said that our ambition for tonight was to discuss two stories from Howard, The Black Stone and Children of the Night. But the Black Stone discussion went on for a while, and it went so well that I think we're going to save. We've decided off mic in an impromptu way to save Children of the Night for another time.
Yeah, it's another story where there's layers and like connections to other Howard stuff, and yeah, like we need to wrap this up, guys. Like this is a good spot. I feel like we did talk about Lovecraft meets Howard. Yeah, let's.
We did it.
We did it. We did the grimoires.
Hooray! We did the thing.
So what? As is traditional for us at the end of a season, what was your favorite story from this season? What was your favorite grimoire? And was there anything that you wish that we had talked about that we can maybe come back to at some point in the future?
Oh, man. I would have to say that I liked this one the most, and that kind of follows. I'm always seemingly on the Howard Road in comparison to you guys. But I think maybe my favorite episode that we made was that very first one where we actually talked about grimoires and kind of what they mean to people and maybe some of the quote unquote real grimoires that you can read about on the internet, like the Grim or the Red Dragon, the what's it called? The Le Rouge des Grimoires or something, yeah. Luke.
Yeah, it is the Red Dragon, right?
Right. Yeah. Just the those kinds of ideas. I think that there's a lot of meat on that bone if we ever wanted to revisit this particular topic. Just talking, maybe even trying to read some grimoires that are out there and see what we can invoke over the audio airwaves. I like that episode a lot, but I liked the Blackstone perhaps the best out of the things that we read.
I really enjoyed the discussion that we had about The King in Yellow. I had never really read those stories before. I think that night was fun, and I think that that is the bleakest of the episodes that we recorded this season. Mm-hmm. Like that's where we really wrestled with notions like antinatalism and you know what is out there, but the yawning void, and what is it all worth anyway?
Right,
time is a flat circle,
and I think we were able to bounce back from that. It did require some substantial bourbon drinking that next episode. But I think that was some good conversation. And, John, like you, I think that the Blackstone is the crown jewel in the story list for this season.
Yeah. Cheating here. I liked pretty much every story we covered this season. I really did enjoy. And so I'm having a hard time picking a topper. I think my favorite in terms of the actual material is the story that we just read. But I think the King in Yellow episode was probably my favorite to do. But I think objectively, maybe the movie episode was our best. Like we hit on, I feel like this season it was short enough, and that was an intentional sort of choice on our part to do something like in 7 or 8 episodes that we could get in and get out and like hit on a topic and talk about it. I feel like it's a lot of all killer, no filler this time around. And that's not tooting the horn. That's just saying that I think we did a good job of like hitting on the major themes that we sought out at the beginning here consistently throughout this season. So I like it. So
the movie episode is a close second for me. I thought we really nailed that one, and I thought we talked through a lot of cool stuff in it, and for three very, while they were unified by their theme in terms of quality and perhaps even execution, they were very different. I thought we had a good thread there that we talked about. I find it very interesting that none of us chose the Necronomicon as our favorite grimoire episode of the season.
Why do you think that is?
Maybe it's a little too been there, done that for us.
I think it's like I think the Necronomicon is like comfort food for grimoires, right? Like, like it's the one that everyone knows. It's the Big Mac. Like, you know what to expect when you order a Cyclopean Eldritch Big Mac.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes any sense or not, but
like, well, I think there's more to say about nameless cults than there is about the Necronomicon in terms of like what the hell we know that that book, like what the lineage is of that book. Like we get, it's not just the mad Arab Abdul Al-Hazrad. Like we get a clearer story of what happened to Von Yuntz with this story. And with the Book of Ivan, shit, we got like actual Ivan stuff.
He was a POV character.
He went to Saturn, dude.
Yeah, he went to Saturn.
another wizard chased him. Like there's crazy stuff that we know more, but that just gets at how these grimoires can be like so broadly sort of painted so that they just sort of are a portrait in the background versus like the motivator of a plot. And in this case, like for tonight's episode, that book is a motivator of the plot. And it's not to say it's better or worse. It's just the different ways that these types of books within stories can sort of play out.
Mm-hmm.
But enough of what we think. What do the listeners believe there, Joshua?
Well, we do have some correspondence from our buddy Evil Ed. The subject of this email is, "Have you found the yellow sign?"
Bro.
Dude,
man.
Have you, like, found the yellow sign? He says, "Great episode, guys. Rereading The King in Yellow made me realize how equally influential Chambers was to John Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness as Lovecraft was in regards to what the effects of reading Sutter Kane's books have on the reader. Can't believe I never thought about that before. What are your thoughts on this? Keep up the excellent work, Ed."
Well, not to get all Deuteronomy on it, but like Chambers begat Lovecraft, Lovecraft begat
Carpenter,
etc. Right? I mean, we could kind of go down that road.
And in terms of how The King in Yellow begets madness, like that's a clear sort of distinction within In the Mouth of Madness. Like that's, yeah, I definitely see like that type of story, be it a play or a novel, you know, pushing towards that.
Evil Ed is always very astute. I assume that he's written a grimoire or two in his century-spanning lifetime.
The Edonomicon. We also have correspondence from our friend Eric, who says, "Greetings, dogs. Listen closely. The first man who doesn't will be very quickly greeting his ancestors in hell."
I like that.
Yeah. "I just wanted to tell you I'm digging the grimoires and the whole cosmic horror vibe going on right now. Sorry, John. I haven't yet found the courage to read The King in Yellow, but I did read the Lovecraft stories you talked about and watching True Detective Season 1 again. I don't sleep so well anymore, so thanks for that. On a different note, I wondered if I might impose on Luke and ask him to answer probably the nerdiest question ever posted to the Cromrads."
Sup, bro?
Listening.
What's up?
Luke's listening, bro. What's wrong with us? "I've been listening to Bourbon and Barbarians. I know you think that's weird, but I enjoy it. I'm pretty sure you are using the same version of D&D that I started playing with my friends in 1982 or so. We bought it in a blue box or a red box, and it was called Advanced D&D, and I think what you guys are playing is pretty much the same thing with a little homebrew in there. I've heard you and Josh mentioned 3.5 and Pathfinder. I don't think I've ever heard anyone mention 4th or 5th edition. I was just wondering if you might talk a little bit about why you like this old version you're using for B&B. I think it's great in many ways myself, but I was curious about your thoughts. Lastly, in keeping with the season content and upcoming Cromtober, have you guys ever played any of the Cthulhu or Delta Green type RPGs?"
Lots of layers to that.
Yeah. So the first one was why, like, what version are we playing and why?
So we're playing like the Rules Cyclopedia BX expanded sort of like basic rule set with some homebrew thrown in related to like skills checks. That's the short statement.
So when you say BX, does that mean basic plus more or less?
Yeah, well, so basic and then X was like the extra levels, like you okay. had the basic modules like B1, B2,
right,
that kind of thing, and then X. So BX is like classic D&D and then AD&D. Like, this is the cool thing about, and I am not like a total grognard because I'm not that old. Like, you know, I was playing D&D during the height of the second edition revised stuff. Like, that's that's when I came into it. And the same thing for you with you, Josh. Like, that's when we were like teenagers, right? But you could plug in AD&D with basic, and those two systems sort of talk to one another. It's just one was more complicated than the other. So there are a variety of those materials that say compatible with like basic and AD&D materials, right? So the bottom line is I wanted to play Keep on the Borderlands and like pull in like classic Greyhawk stuff. So that's kind of the setting. And then I just tried to like homebrew up like some quick and easy rule sets that worked for people that hadn't played D&D before.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's
yeah.
And John, you've never played before, so you're coming in with this.
There's a lot of language here that,
dude. But you can't. But you can't say that anymore, dude. You played D&D for like
you were just like, oh, we're doing like BX homebrew, but something. I was like, whatever. Sure. All I know is I roll the dice.
You've played.
That's not true.
But you've played
a monster, or you didn't.
You know the rules.
You've played Dungeons and Dragons for 2 years.
2 years
in the grand scheme of like.
I'm not arguing that I've never played Dungeons and Dragons. I'm just saying. There is a level of knowledge that I have not obtained yet.
But what I would say though to that is, imagine if you will, you were a 15-year-old who first discovered a glorious game called Dungeons and Dragons, and then fast forward 2 years between sophomore and senior in high school, like you know the rules.
You do know. You might.
Oh, I feel comfortable playing with you. I mean, I screwed up the one time with critical saves and all that kind of stuff, but.
It was your reflex.
Way more comfortable now than I did previously.
Yeah.
But there is a depth of lingo that is there's a grimoire out there that would probably tell me about it. I haven't read it yet.
It's the rule cyclopedia. Yeah.
That's a good point. I have that on my desktop here.
Then Eric's second question was, have you guys played any of the Cthulhu or Delta Green type RPGs?
So we've not done Delta Green. We've not done any D20 Cthulhu type stuff, nor have we done Chaosium.
Right.
Call of Cthulhu stuff. We've done like Savage Worlds.
Yeah.
Call of Cthulhu.
Can you
homebrewy stuff.
Can you give a synopsis of one of those games?
Narlathotep got wrangled into a blues carnival sideshow.
Yes.
So,
yep.
Yeah, that's a
What was the game that we played and drank limoncello during?
HeroQuest?
That was HeroQuest.
HeroQuest.
Yeah.
Yeah, so and in terms of like 3.5, that's what Josh and I played like throughout our grad school experience.
Mm-hmm.
I mean 3.5 like to the bone is kind of the system that I have the most like hours logged playing.
Yeah, for sure.
Like,
for
me too. As a player, for sure. And then 4E ain't messed with it really. 5E, I bought the starter box. Like I've got the starter, like the starter box for that. I bought it for super cheap on Amazon whenever it came out. And then I was like, nah, I think I want to like get the Chromecast dudes to play like basic. So I bought that starter box right when we first played. We started doing Keep on the Borderlands, but I opted for the BX stuff just because I thought it would be funner. The most funs.
It is the most funs.
I don't know if it is, but it is fun.
We have one more piece of feedback. This one comes from Twitter. Our friend Zachary says, good podcast, guys. Interesting to learn of Robert W. Chambers' short stories. I like how you had some differing appreciation of The Yellow Sign. Keep up the good work.
Have you seen The Yellow Sign?
I have. Once. It's been
every day between the red and the green.
It's pretty good. That's the yellow signal, dude.
Oh, crap. This is why I don't belong on the Chromecast.
No, you do belong. You're the heart of it.
Is that why I don't like cosmic horror?
It might be.
Yeah. Because I would be the heart of Captain Planet.
Yeah.
It's Captain Weird Tales, he's our hero.
So if our powers combined is Captain Weird Tales and you're the heart, what is Luke and what am I?
Leadership, Joshua.
I'm not the leader.
Josh is the spirit, and I'm the brains.
Spirit and brains. Okay.
That's not
heart, spirit, and brains.
I don't know, like mind, heart, spirit,
Trinity.
Will is will like the better word?
Heart, I don't know.
Will.
I feel like we are best encapsulated by Kirk, Spock, and Bones. And Josh is Kirk, you're Spock, and I'm Bones.
I absolutely would agree with that. Like that triumvirate. That is the way to think about it. Because we're all fairly hardy. We're all fairly smarty. We're all fairly willful.
We're doing a literary show. I haven't read the story, but steady as she goes.
Damn it, dude, Josh. I love it. I love it. That's how we're going to go with this.
I did read the stories.
Kirk, Bones.
Damn it, Kirk.
Spockster. I dig it.
Nice. this is devolving, so we should put a pin in it, I guess.
Pop the balloon.
Oh, wait. No, we actually do have one more email I wanted to read, and that is from our friend Rusty Burke. Rusty says, I know you already discussed the Necronomicon, and geez, I'm still trying to finish listening to the first episode, and you've already posted the third. But I thought maybe you'd like to read one of my favorite Necronomicon stories, The Adder, by Fred Chappell. Also, here's a link to another good one, The Terrible Parchment, by Manly Wade Wellman. And so he provided a link to both of those stories. So thanks, Rusty. We weren't able to work those into this season, but as we've mentioned before, there's a wealth of grimoire-influenced weird fiction out there. And so I feel like this is a theme that is rife for revisiting at some point.
Yep. I want to do the, what do you say, like the MW squared season? Like the
I'd love to, yeah.
The Manly Wade Wellman
MWW season.
That's an untapped vein, sirs.
Yes.
We could get the load. The load of precious mineral.
The Manly Road?
That's pretty funny. I like it.
So I guess, well, I should say thanks, Rusty, for letting us know about those stories. I haven't read either one of them yet, but they're going to go on my pile.
Yeah, man. There's that's the thing. There's so many of these damn stories. There's so many of these authors. It's
cool.
It's why the Chromecast will never die.
I mean, and we're not even hitting on new stuff, right? Like, there's just so many old authors and good stuff out there. There's so much good new stuff too, but we're staying busy with a lot of this old stuff.
Yeah, and we're gonna stay busy for some
season 45.
I'm 80. and so we should say goodbye to the Road of Magic, the Road of Knowledge, we never settled on a name for this season, and we should look ahead.
We're going to leave it at that. We're not going to say where we're going, because we're stuck in a cornfield, right?
That's right. We're in this cornfield, and the moon casts bitter light, and shadows fall all around us, for it is the time of the reaping and the harvest. It is the time of the witch. It is the time of Gromtober.
When I look out my window, many sights to see. And when I look in my window, so many different people to be. That it's strange, so strange. You got to pick up every stitch. You got to pick up every stitch. You got to pick up every stitch. Mm-hmm. Must be the season of the witch. Must be the season of the witch, yeah. Shoulder. What do you think I see. Some other cat looking over his shoulder at me. And he's strange. Sure is strange. You got to pick up every stitch. You got to pick up every stitch, yeah. Beatniks out to make it rich. Oh no, must be the season of the rich. Must be the season of the rich, yeah. Must be the season of the rich.
Shoot!